Our High Court is getting ready for a big stoush. The federal government wants to overturn the ACT laws that permit gay marriage. And this month, it's 10 years since a court in the US kick-started debate on the issue. That story's coming up in a moment here on the Religion and Ethics Report. And also, a British Muslim doctor recalls her recent work in the midst of Syria's civil war. It's a harrowing account. Well, back in 2004, I was living in the US covering the presidential election. And the Democratic candidate, John Kerry, was trying to deny George W. Bush a second term as president. Bush's victory that November was one of the narrowest in presidential history. He was actually pushed over the line by winning the key state of Ohio. And one of the factors that rallied religious conservatives behind President Bush was a series of ballot measures, including one in Ohio, that prohibited same-sex marriage. And in November 2003, that's almost 10 years ago exactly, the Massachusetts Supreme Court had effectively legalized gay marriage. Now, at the time, it was a big political headache for the Democrats because public support for gay marriage stood at about 30%. Well, how times change. According to a recent Washington Post ABC poll, support is now 58%, and 16 states allow gay marriage, including the big ones, New York and California and New Jersey. And before last year's presidential elections, before the election itself, Barack Obama declared himself a supporter. So how did this go from being a career killer for politicians to being a vote winner? The US writer Jonathan Rauch was in Australia recently for the Public Knowledge Forum, which was organised by the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney. And he's written widely on the topic, including the book Gay Marriage, Why It's Good for Gays, Good for Straights and Good for America. I asked Jonathan Rauch why public opinion had turned so dramatically in just 8 years.
A few things happened all at once. One is a lot of gay people came out, and this became an issue of friends and families and wanting your own kids to be gay. Another is that the argument against gay marriage just didn't hold up over time. You know, the claim was that somehow if gay people could marry, straight families would suffer, but no one was ever able to show why that was going to happen. And a third thing that happened was eventually civil rights arguments began to take hold as states one at a time initially very gradually adopted gay marriage and nothing bad happened. And I think all those things came together and sort of created a tipping point.
And there was this phenomenon that we have explored on this program before that Robert Putnam points to in his research, and that is that Americans came to know and befriend or realize that many of their friends and relatives were also gay.
Yes, support for same-sex marriage and for gay equality generally correlates very strongly with whether you know or have a family member who is gay. And as more gay people have come out, that's been very important over time.
Yeah, this is called the Aunt Susan effect in Robert Putnam's research.
Homophobia and hatred of gays has been driven over the years by the notion that we're somehow a threat to society, that we're alien and different and will harass children. None of that's ever been true. And as we become part of the American fabric of society, we stop being scary.
I wonder if it's also to do with the weakening of the religious right as a major force in American politics. That's something else that Putnam points to. Has your research found that?
Well, the religious right remains a very important force, but in the Republican Party. There is one large group that remains unalterably and deeply opposed to same-sex marriage, and it's white evangelical Protestants, often otherwise known as the religious right. They're 75% opposed, and that's more than enough within the Republican Party to keep the entire party opposed to gay marriage. So it remains politically very controversial.
I'm wondering, though, if part of this transition can also be attributed to something that you raise in your cover story for the recent edition of American Review, and that is the conservative case for same-sex marriage. I mean, that it is about family values in a way.
This was perhaps in some ways the single most important intellectual breakthrough. I think when gay people were saying, you know, this is equality, give us equal rights, you're a bunch of you know, homophobes or bigots if you oppose this. This didn't make the same impression as when it began to dawn on people, gay and straight people alike, that no, this is a conservative movement, that what we were asking for was we wanted to be better spouses for each other. We wanted to build families. We wanted to be better community members. And marriage does all that. It brings people into communities. It strengthens families. It's a conservative institution.
Yes, well, I think you say in this piece that same-sex couples actually, they really want to subscribe to that conventional mores.
Yes, and this all goes along with what I call the gay responsibility revolution. There was a gay rights movement for many years. It's morphed to being about, instead of give us equal rights, give us equal responsibility, three M's, marriage, service in the military, and mentoring, the care and mentoring of children. And in all of those cases, gay Americans have been saying, let us participate in giving back to society. And that, I think, has been a watershed.
Is that necessarily, though, popular among the entire gay community? I'll give you an example. In Australia, our former Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, based her opposition to gay marriage on the fact that she said she came of age politically at a time when marriage as an institution itself was being questioned. So I'm wondering if in some of the more older libertarian sections of the gay rights movement, this notion of marriage has itself been treated with indifference or even hostility.
10 years ago, Andrew, I published a book called Gay Marriage, Why It's Good for Gays, Good for Straights, and Good for Americans. And on my book tour, I would find very often when I was talking to gay audiences of a certain generation, people in their 60s and older, the so-called Stonewall generation, we called it, that they had this view that marriage was this bourgeois institution that didn't really suit gays and didn't really suit societies. And in the intervening years, that view has been essentially trampled by ordinary gay couples who've been voting with their feet overwhelmingly. They want to participate in this institution. And now I think the liberal, libertarian case against marriage is a minor remnant fading very fast.
Tell me about the diverse church response to this issue.
You know, most mainline religions are still opposed to gay marriage, but that's also beginning to crack. It's following the larger culture. We've seen endorsements initially by the Church of Christ and the Unitarians, and now it's spreading to Episcopal churches and elsewhere. So I've said for years that the final social transformation will come when mainline churches are conducting and blessing gay matrimony, and I think we're only probably now 10 or 20 years from that.
That continues to be, though, an interesting debate. I mean, you wrote a piece some years ago with David Blankenhorn, a well-known conservative, a friend of yours, I believe, where you thought, though, that you'd reached an accommodation whereby the churches would accept civil unions, recognise absolute equality in civil unions, but not require recognition from the churches. Now, he's moved on from that position, I understand.
Well, in America, no one wants to require recognition from the churches because of the way our Constitution works. The government can't impose anything in terms of church recognition, nor do gay people want that. We want to win this through the power of ideas and the power of love. But yes, a few years ago in 2009, I co-wrote an article with David Blankenhorn, who was then perhaps one of the two leading opponents of gay marriage, saying, well, we can't agree on marriage, but let's at least agree on an interim step, a form of civil unions. But the country's moved on. You know, it moved right past that, and so has David Blankenhorn, who's now a supporter of marriage equality.
Knowing him well, Jonathan, what do you attribute his change of heart to?
He says it's because as he got to know me and other gay people, he increasingly began to see this as an attempt by Americans trying to form families to have the same family structures that straight people have. I think he originally saw gay marriage as an attempt to undermine the institution of marriage, and I think instead he came to see it as new recruits to the institution of marriage at a time when it badly needs some.
Let's move to a broader question around this issue. You and I are sitting here having a very civil discussion, but I believe that you're a great advocate of uncivil discussion in some ways. You've written that the same-sex marriage argument, indeed the broader gay rights movement in America, is helped by what might be considered hate speech.
Well, here's the moment for me to plug the new edition of my best book, Kindly Inquisitors, The New Attacks on Free Thought, which argues that for minorities especially, it's very important that society allow robust open criticism, including speech that's often considered hate speech. We benefit from that. It's very hard to remember now, but 30, 40, 50 years ago, advocacy of gay equality was considered hate speech. It was considered an attack on children and on society. And the great advantage that gay people had in the United States is we were free to make our case at a time when absolutely no one wanted to hear it. We had the power of ideas on our side, and we had the power of public criticism, which is very good at sorting out fact from fiction. And so I argue today that we of all people, minorities, but especially gays, have an important stake in remembering the importance of free speech and free thought in getting us where we've been.
So what are the limits, though? I mean, surely there must be limits in this country. We have limits on speech that encourages racial hatred, that encourages violence. I mean, you're surely not an absolutist on this position, are you?
Well, almost no one is a true absolutist, and the United States has laws which I support on, for example, libel and directed harassment and so forth. On the other hand, we don't have laws against hate speech. Those are unconstitutional in our country, and I would argue we are getting that right. One of the reasons we have such a vigorous intellectual culture in the United States is it's still possible to say things that are outrageous, because once in a while one of those outrageous things is true.
The opposite end of your argument in favour of pretty acerbic, vigorous debate is what you've called apathyism. Tell us about apathyism.
Apathyism is my tongue-in-cheek word for a world in which people care less and less about whether other people are religious, which is the direction the United States has moved. And I think it's a positive direction, actually. It is true that in the United States, within organized religion, there has been a movement into more strict, hardline churches. But this obscures the much larger movement away from church going generally and toward a kind of secularism, which is not, Andrew, atheism. It's not people disbelieving in God. It's people being more relaxed about religion generally. The people who are relevant in America now are the apatheists, the people who don't really care that much about God, and some will describe themselves as agnostics, a few will say they're atheists, but most are just secular people who live their lives as though God doesn't exist, even though they may say he does. And it turns out to be a very healthy, sustainable lifestyle, greatly underrated, in my opinion.
But one of the things I found interesting in your article was you say many apatheists, or how do you pronounce that?
I call it apatheists.
Apatheists still go to church. There's something about the religious community that they like.
Oh, absolutely. So much of religion is not about hardcore belief. It's about what you do with other people and how you relate to them. We get a lot of press in America about our polarization and our government dysfunction, and unfortunately much of it is deserved. But quietly, there are some things we're getting right, and one of them is a movement toward a more relaxed view of religion in which you can participate, but you don't have to let it run other people's lives.
Yes, well, you ping yourself, as it were, as an apatheist. There's a joke about the Jewish apatheists.
The Orthodox rabbi gets a call from a member of his congregation saying that the son wants a Harley for his bar mitzvah. What's a Harley? And the Orthodox rabbi says, well, gosh, I don't really know. So he calls the conservative rabbi and says, one of my congregants' son wants a Harley for his bar mitzvah. What's a Harley? The conservative rabbi says, I don't really know. So he calls the reform rabbi, says the same thing. Wants a Harley for his bar mitzvah, what's that? And the reform rabbi says, a Harley's a motorcycle, what's a bar mitzvah?
Very good. We like to get as many Jewish jokes on the show as we can. Well, Jonathan Rausch, thank you very much for being on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
And there's a link to Jonathan Rausch's cover story in the latest edition of American Review at our homepage on the RN website. And you're with me, Andrew West. Well, there can be no jokes about the war in Syria. According to a new report by the London-based Oxford Research Group, more than 11,000 children have died in the war. It's the first major investigation into child deaths since the war began in 2011. The highest number of child deaths occurred in the region of Aleppo, which is divided between government and opposition forces. And there, more than 2,000 children have been killed. In September this year, the BBC was filming at a medical clinic in Aleppo. Suddenly, Assad government forces dropped a bomb, which some doctors likened to napalm, on a school playground nearby. The BBC film crew was following the journey of two British medics who'd travelled to Syria as volunteers. Our producer, Jess Hill, is speaking via Skype to one of them, the doctor and journalist Saleha Hassan, about what she saw.
I was approached by Dr. Ruller a while ago to talk about healthcare in Syria. She knew that I'd been in Libya, and I think she just wanted someone to talk to who maybe worked in conflict zones before. And the more I spoke to her, the more I realised the horror of what was going on. And I really feel that sometimes you've just got to go there and see it so that you can bear witness and give testimony. And professionally, medically, I thought, they're depleted of manpower. You know, maybe I can give someone a day off and take their shift for them. And it was as simple as that.
You went into Syria with another doctor who you just mentioned, Dr. Rola Halam, and a BBC crew. The documentary of your journey is called Saving Syria's Children, and it's incredibly harrowing, especially the scenes that were shot just after Assad forces dropped a bomb on a school near the hospital you were volunteering in. Before we talk about that, let's just have a quick listen to what was captured on tape that day.
Some kind of airstrike seems to have taken place. Most of the casualties are teenagers. They're saying a bomb has landed in their school playground.
There's dozens of people that have just been rushed in, covered in burns and some white powder dust. Their clothes are hanging off them.
It's only 5 days since the chemical attack in Damascus, and everyone's terrified that there's just been another one.
Those scenes are hard to listen to, but even harder to watch. Can you tell us what you saw that day?
It was quite a quiet day, and I was beginning to think, oh gosh, I've really got my timing wrong, because what's the point of me being here if I'm not going to be helping out? And then suddenly, standing to my left, I just saw this rather strange vision. I felt as if I was having an out-of-body experience because I couldn't quite work out what I was seeing. There was a boy covered in this strange white dust, had wide staring eyes, his clothes were hanging off him, and he had this huge laceration on the side of his face, and his skin looked like it had areas of burn. And he was saying in a very calm voice, where shall I go, Ukhti, which means sister in Arabic. So I grabbed him and started to walk him out. And as I was walking, I realised that, hold on, again, that bed's taken by another patient and the two beds in the other room are taken. And then I sort of disengaged from the boy for a second and just looked up. And in front of my eyes, the place was heaving. And it had happened in moments. As I'm describing it, it happened like that. Suddenly, we were overflowing with patients. We didn't know what we were dealing with initially. And then 40 badly burnt majority kids ranging from the ages of 14 to 18 started to descend upon us en masse. And my initial thoughts in those first few seconds, because imagine my mind's racing, is we're under attack. And it's weird. You never know how you're going to respond in those situations until you're actually there. And obviously, Gita was in my mind and I thought, okay, this is potentially a chemical attack, because I started to see medical staff grabbing white masks and putting them on. And at this point, I didn't have one. And I just thought, this sounds strange. I just thought, okay, I'm going to start feeling something in a second. And then someone thrust a white mask over my face. And then as more and more people came through, we realised it wasn't a chemical bomb. It was a thermal incendiary device.
And I mean, you wrote that the headmaster of the school described fire falling like rain, burning whatever it touched. So what was in that incendiary device that created that effect?
Peter Buckhart, who is a weapons expert from Human Rights Watch, has said he believes it's a Soviet-made ZAB incendiary device. Now, this bomb apparently is really nasty. So it carries the fuel in a gel, and when that drops, that gel sticks. It sticks to whatever it finds, and it stuck in this case to skin. And the purpose is to stick in and burn deeper, which is precisely what it did with these kids.
In incidents like this, there are often a few people that you just can't get out of your mind. Is there anybody in particular that still stays with you?
Yeah, there was a boy. 18 years old. His name was Anas, and he was the only son of his family. He was quite tall. I couldn't make out his face because his eyes were swollen and almost closed. His hair was almost melted, and he had this black tarry stuff stuck to his head and his face, and he just kept saying, "I want to sleep, I want to sleep." His dad was standing near him. His dad was so quiet and keeping himself together for his son, and we managed to give him painkillers, got fluids into him as soon as possible, which is trying to cool him down. And he's the only son, the eldest kid, and he died in Turkey.
It's not the first time we've seen a school bombed in Syria, but what we're also seeing is hospitals and medical professionals specifically targeted by the Assad regime. The UN reported that Assad forces are deliberately attacking doctors and hospitals. And according to the World Health Organization, 37% of Syrian hospitals have been destroyed. How does that make you feel as a doctor?
I am so appalled. I am so appalled. The UN have done this amazing report. They've been collecting data for two and a half years. So my question is, so now what? Now what? What, it carries on? It goes unchecked? What are you going to do about it? I don't see many very difficult questions being put to members of the Assad government when they're being interviewed. I mean, I want to know why Assad's regime feel that they can just, you know, it's part of their daily brief almost to, yeah, you know, your job today is to go and get that hospital.
That's what the UN says, is that they're being attacked as a matter of policy.
I mean, that's breathtaking. And to think that Assad was a doctor, I don't recognise him personally myself as one anymore. I just think, so, you know, who is putting pressure on this side? Who's talking about that? And I think this is where doctors are doing it for themselves. The Lancet, the journal, The Lancet published a letter signed by 55 medics from around the world, all from different backgrounds, quite prominent, just basically saying that, you know, let us treat patients in Syria and try not to kill us for doing our job. And I just find it breathtaking that you can kill someone who is doing that job. I can't actually even articulate it. I'm kind of a bit speech. I need some distance between me and this to be able to think about it properly. I'm just appalled.
Having witnessed all of that trauma, especially coming from the point of view of a doctor, how are you reconciling that now inside yourself and dealing with it?
I don't think I'm dealing with it yet. I'm just trying to keep busy because it's weird. Dealing with kids who've had burns, I'm learning now, is one of the most traumatic things that medics deal with. What I dealt with in Syria were up to 40 very severely burned people with up to 70 to 80% burns, second to third degree. And the younger you are, the worse chances you have of surviving. And a colleague of mine said that, you know, she dealt with two burn kids from a house fire and ended up needing time off because it's really traumatic. So I'm just thinking, when is this wave of whatever going to hit me because of the numbers and the severity that I dealt with? And not just me, but my colleagues who are still out there dealing with that. I'm here, I'm lucky. I came home and I'm away from that. I don't have the threat of a MiG flying above me when I go to work, but my Syrian colleagues are still out there dealing with that. When are they going to get to switch off? I just don't know. I tell you what was really heartbreaking. I was talking to one of my colleagues. He was actually in Turkey visiting some of the patients from that blast, and we broke for a minute because he said, "Oh, do you hear that? That's music. That's the Turkish wedding." And it was really loud. And he said, "You know what people are saying? They're saying, when will we be able to laugh and dance and hear music in Syria? When will it be our time? When will that happen? When will it all be over so that we can all come out onto the streets without being afraid?" And I have to say, I just felt so small. I felt tiny when he said that because it just seems so far away. If, you know, I'm not I'm still not thinking. I kind of haven't worked out me yet. I feel like I'm rather irrelevant to worry about it right now. People are having to deal with life and death and survival.
But that's also often a response that people have once they're back in a safe place, is that my experience is nothing compared to what people are still experiencing. And it's a natural thing for us to say and to feel, like there's a hierarchy almost of pain and of turmoil, but it's still important for you to look after yourself and to recognise the incredible thing that you've been through. Do you have, are you still at work at the moment, or do you have any plans to really take that time out to care for yourself?
When I'm busy, I'm not thinking about it. So being busy is good. Having downtime is not good, because that's when I think about it and that's when I get upset and I feel useless. And I'm not the crying type, but, you know, moments when I'm even on a train, on the underground, traveling into London to do an interview, for example, about this, I'll just be sitting and staring, and suddenly, it's so weird, I've never experienced it before, I'll just start to cry, and, you know, I'll have to bury myself into a newspaper or something, and it'll be a fleeting moment, and I won't even know why. I won't even necessarily be thinking about out there or the people I met, but I suppose I'm learning about my own response to my experience. I've also had some wonderful, wonderful support from fellow members of the media. You know, I'm on my own dealing with a whole array of emotions, and things that you're saying yourself, what you're describing, makes me think, oh God, I'm so glad you're saying that, because I'm not crazy. You know, this is normal. And so that helps.
You're certainly not alone. There's a lot of people who are dealing with this stuff. But there's another thing I wanted to talk to you about. Are you religious? Do you have a personal faith?
Yeah, well, I'm a Muslim, and I have to say that, you know, faith, I think whatever your faith is really important at times like this. It also challenges it. I have to say that mine was challenged, but it was always there. It's always the backbone of what I am and what I do, and it goes with me.
You mentioned briefly there that you'd had your faith challenged while you were in Syria. You've just been in a country where Muslims are killing other Muslims. What does the Quran say about this, and how do you reflect on the teachings of the Quran when you see this happening?
Do you know, so many bad things have happened that I just think people were kind of off the page at the moment with what the Quran says. I think Islam is the religion, and Muslims are people, are human beings, and human beings do bad things, whatever your religion. And I think this is what we've got here. And I think what also is very sad is that Syrians are killing Syrians, people that they may well have known and worked together, or they were all Syrians together, and they're killing each other. And I think that was quite hard to sort of witness and see. And in terms of faith, yeah, people observe faith, but human beings are human beings, and historically they've just been bad to each other.
The British doctor and writer Saleha Hassan speaking there with our producer Jess Hill. Our stories are at our homepage on the RN website. You can download or stream them, and you can leave a comment, and you can follow us on Twitter at ABC Religion. Thanks to Jess Hill and our technical producer Joe Wallace. Drivers next with Jonathan Green. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello there, Andrew. And look, staying with religion a bit tonight, after seven, we'll look at Pope Francis's apostolic exhortation, something of a mission statement for his papacy, and some wonderful language in it. Says the Pope, there are Christians whose lives seem like Lent without Easter. So more on that after the 7 o'clock news on RN Drive. Before we get there, well, Gonski continues to unravel. The Education Minister has found some money, and that's being distributed to some of the non-Gonski states. We'll look at that. Also at something of the détente, the rapprochement between Australia and Indonesia, a new code of conduct. Meet Kurt Campbell, perhaps the man who might be one day soon the US Secretary of State. We ask him whether that's the case. And in the drawing room in our final 20 minutes this evening before 8, well, we're going to talk about sex, or at least we're going to have a conversation about how we don't have a conversation about sex. if that makes any sense. That's all coming up on RN Drive straight after the 6 o'clock news. News time now, 6 o'clock.
Storytelling in the digital era is a powerful means of bringing the private and disparate into the public gaze.
Quentin Bryce's Boyer Lectures are about stories, old and new, and how they help us reimagine a fairer Australia.
A nation that takes care of our neighbours, that understands that human stories are powerful agents of learning and change. It's okay for the personal to be political.
You can download the Boyers from the RN homepage.